Welcome, everybody, to Art of Advisory. My name is Hector Garcia, and I'm here with my co-host, Kirk Bowman. Hey, Kirk, how are you?
I'm good, Hector. What's going on, my friend?
So we just came back from a big show from Scaling New Heights, based out of Atlanta, Georgia. Both of us spoke different sessions, and there was quite a bit of this sort of overwhelming message that the computers are taking over and that artificial intelligence is taking over a lot of the mundane tasks. I guess that was the theme of the show anyway. It's not like it was supposed to be anything else other than that. But what did you take from the show? What were some takeaways that you had from Scaling New Heights this year?
As far as the show went, you know, I think it just really reinforced the theme that, you know, if we're truly being advisors, then we don't have to worry about AI, you know, artificial intelligence, that kind of thing, because we're going to be doing the things that machines can't do if we're acting as true advisors. So, you know, it was interesting, learned some things, but it, you know, several of the sessions that I taught were kind of in the theme of transcending the machines, you know, this idea that, you know, we are going to specialize in the things that machines can't do. So we don't have to worry about the fact that they are doing it, because what we do, they're not capable of it, at least certainly not yet. And all that boils down to things that require judgment. And it's the use of judgment in our practice as professionals that really is the most valuable thing. We just got to get up the courage to use it. What about you?
Yeah, you know what? I until you said it, it didn't click. What you just said, but I think you're absolutely right. I think that our theme of a show is Art of Advisory. And if you are focused on being an advisor, I don't think a machine could ever replace us. I mean, that's as insightful as it gets. I think the show lacked that message, I believe. I believe there was just a lot of technical points. They were making the technical points that computers are getting more intricate. They're becoming more ubiquitous, that, you know, software and automation is becoming more and more part of everybody's everyday life. And it's coming to a point that we don't notice it anymore. Like, you know, there are things happening behind the scenes and we don't notice them. And they're just making our life a lot more convenient. Like, you know, you take Facebook, for example. You know, when you log into Facebook, a lot of the information about your entire network is being curated for you. You know, the folks that you tend to look at their pictures more will show up on top of the list. The folks that you tend to comment more will show up if there's more sort of other people commenting on their stuff. So, like, artificial intelligence, which, by the way, it's just fancy talk for software. I think just the word artificial intelligence itself is scary. And Steve Forbes, which was on the main stage, I think he made such a great point. He said, when cars came about, we never called cars artificial horses. And cars, when you compare a car versus a horse, that is as robotic futurism and artificial intelligence as it gets, you know, from that time. So now we're calling software, which is just software, we're calling it artificial intelligence, and all of a sudden it's scary. But it's just software, isn't it? I mean, Kirk, am I missing something here?
No, I think it's a good point. I unfortunately didn't get to see Steve Forbes. Had something going on. But yeah, I agree. You know, I think the reason we call it artificial intelligence, it's really just because of sci-fi, right? The idea that, you know, technology is going to take over the world, whether it's, you know, Star Trek with Utopia or Star Wars, where we have all this tech, but, you know, there's still this fight between good and evil or whatever it is. We just call it artificial intelligence because another reason, I guess, would be because of the idea that since it's not real intelligence, you know, we call it artificial, but bottom line is we're just learning how to empower advisors to do more of the things that truly matter with their customers. So I see it as an advisor, as an empowerment of the advisor.
I mean, look, let's think about QuickBooks, for example, right? So when QuickBooks came out, and this is back in the 80s, and now obviously 30 years later, or maybe 90s, I don't want to exaggerate, but you had a piece of software that now makes that if you go back 20, 30 years ago and how accounting was being built, it makes it much easier and faster for us to prepare a financial statement. And a financial statement is just a tool that we use to give advice to our clients on how to manage their business better. We don't call QuickBooks artificial intelligence, but it is software, and it is taking over some of the stuff that we used to do. So I just think that if the word artificial intelligence is scary, don't use it. I mean, if a client is scared of artificial intelligence, don't say, hey, we're going to implement a software that through artificial intelligence is going to tell us what to focus on. And if your customer is scared about that, just don't use the word. It's just software. I think that maybe they call it artificial intelligence, other than your point about sci-fi, is because I think developers are trying to model software to sort of react the way a human would. I mean, maybe that's why they're calling it artificial intelligence, because they are modeling software after human behavior and after human brain. And I think that may be a missed opportunity, because, you know, if you want software to be a great addition to what we do, maybe we don't want software to behave like humans. Maybe we want software to behave like software and to behave like robots. That way it allows the humans to take the human element of the results from this, you know, robotic computation and translate it into something that another human would understand and would turn it into a viable task. You know, only humans can understand facial expressions and see when someone is confused or anxious. You know, computers, I guess not yet, can do that. So I think our job really is to leverage computers and software as much as possible, so we can spend more time with our customer. I think that's another miss of the communication of what software can do. You know, I think a lot of these software companies sell software as a point of efficiency. We're going to give you software so you're more efficient. And accountants automatically think, oh, efficiency means I spend less time on the client, and I think that's. That's great. I mean, because obviously it's a path towards more profitability, quote unquote. But the idea is to then take that efficiency and that save time on the Monday task and translate that into FaceTime with your customer. I mean, I think that was sort of part of the missing message that we're getting from some of these software companies and the whole artificial intelligence movement.
Well, I would add, and you knew I was going there because you brought it up, that, you know, if you're worried about increasing efficiency is going to hurt your bottom line, then you've got the wrong business model. And of course, you've got the wrong business model for a lot of reasons. But a business model based on time has never been a good business model, but it's certainly not a good business model when you're in a business environment where the things that you have done in the past yourself, you either can do faster or a machine can replace you and do it. Billing based on the time, an hourly rate makes no sense. You know, so I think that's one reason why there might, you know, there's probably multiple, but at least two different camps at a show like Scaling New Heights, especially when you have a topic about, you know, taming the machines, this idea of, you know, artificial intelligence. You kind of got one group who have already changed the business model to value pricing, where they're actually incentivized to work smarter, not incentivized to work more, you know, and the idea that if they work faster, they still make the same amount of money. It doesn't matter how long it takes. In fact, customers actually appreciate, you know, something delivered faster. And so they're excited about it. And then you've got another group who, by the hour, they're like, oh shoot. So I'm going to get this done faster, or I'm not going to do it at all. What am I going to come up with to replace it? Right. And so your business model has an effect on how you perceive this coming wave. Is it something that you see as a threat, or is it actually something that you're excited about? And I'm sure there's people in the middle that, you know, kind of a hybrid of the two, but I definitely saw that. You know, one thing I'll mention, I did a session on the Why Conversation. It was the first session I did, and it was probably the biggest session. I had probably 100 people in that session. And obviously, the why conversation is one of the big three core principles of value pricing. And it was interesting, you know, I didn't label the session value pricing. I just said, well, we're going to talk about why. And I just made an assumption that anybody who was interested in talking about why was going to be interested in, you know, a business model that fit that. Not necessarily. And the way I found it out was I mentioned at one point, I just kind of the idea of time came up. I think somebody asked a question and I said, you know, I said, I'm not going to bash the timesheet. And I literally got applause for not bashing the timesheet, which totally shocked me. You know, but that's an idea of, you know, I kind of had the two audiences in the room. I literally had, you know, they were interested in why, but yet I still had one group who probably, you know, was more worried about technology replacing them because their business model is based on effort versus a group who wasn't worried about it, was actually excited about not having to do as much and still be able to make the same amount or more.
I think some folks, and I think it may be one of the reasons why you had those two groups and some people actually clapped because you said, I'm not going to mess with the timesheet. I think that there are a group of people that have the mindset that they want to transform, but they want to do it in steps. You know, they want to say, okay, I'm open to, you know, to expanding my conversations with my client, but I'm not open to getting rid of the timesheet yet. You know, I'm opening to charging some flat fees, but I'm not ready to get rid of the hourly rate yet. You know, I'm open to offering more advisory services, but I'm not ready to give up compliance work yet. You know, I think a lot of folks just get a little bit overwhelmed by, you know, this multi-tiered message that you have to transform everything and basically flip your practice upside down. And I would say, look, I sympathize with some of those folks, and I would say that's okay. I mean, some transformations can take 5 years, and 5 years is a good timeline. You know, if you're going to completely transform your business model and take, you know, five segments of it and do it one per year, I think that's totally okay. But I'll tell you, sometimes a lot of the genius comes from completely disrupting it and doing it all in one shot. That's why a lot of folks like you and other folks are trying to advocate for a different business model are saying, no, there's a multiple layer of things you need to do. You need to get rid of hourly billing. You need to get rid of the timesheet. You need to spend more time with your clients. You need to price higher. You need to offer options. You need to change your entire business model. And that just becomes really overwhelming for folks, on top of the fact that they have to deal with all these new technologies that are coming into play. And it sounds and it feels like it's going to threaten our livelihood. And I think you have two choices. You can either just wait for change to happen to you, or you can ride the wave and change with the times yourself. So, just as a general suggestion to anyone looking to transform their practice, I think it's okay whichever route you go. Just kind of keep an open mind that a lot of us that I will be advocating a business model change will probably throw multiple things at you at the same time. With that said, Kirk, I want to give you some kudos, because that first session you taught, you had no projector screen for whatever reason. In that classroom, they didn't have the projector screen ready, and you had to teach for 100 minutes without having any slides. And you know what? One thing, that class was really highly rated. I was speaking to folks afterwards, and they were just pretty much very content with the class. You know, maybe you're great at teaching, or maybe it was the first class, so they're very excited. Maybe a combination of the two. But the fact that you pulled it off without a projector, it's both, you know, great kudos to you, but also, do we actually need slides to have impactful conversations with people? And that was something I took away from it. I was like, you know, could I present a great piece of content without having slides at all? And I think it's very achievable. I think you pulled it off.
The advantage of that is you won't know when I go off script. I said the disadvantage of that is you won't know when I go off script. You know, so it's interesting you bring that up. Thanks for the compliment. I appreciate that. I've had stuff like that happen before, so it wasn't the first time that I've had to kind of, you know, move forward with some technical challenges. But, you know, one thing I want to ask, I'm going to get on my soapbox, but I don't know any other way to unpack this. So, you know, So first of all, do you need slides to speak? I think not. Okay. And I think there's, you know, the slides where, you know, it's bullet, you know, somebody brings up a slide, it's got six bullet points and they go through every one. to me, there's just no value in those. I think it's horrible. And you've seen my slides, right? I use very minimalistic slides. I use black background, white text. It's either typically one or two words, a key term, or sometimes it might be a quote, but my slides are very minimalistic. And one reason is I don't want people focusing on slides. I want people focusing on the content. But it's interesting. If you'd asked me 2 weeks ago before the show how I felt about turning in slides in advance of people having them, I would have said, I think it's a horrible idea. Because, and this is what I was getting on my soapbox about, is the idea of turning in slides and people having the slides, as you're going through it. I understand people want to use the slides to evaluate the content, although, at least from my slides, people can evaluate the content because there's not enough in the slides to know, and that's the other thing. I kind of use the slides as I don't want people to know where I'm going. That's part of the intrigue. It's part of the mystery. It's that kind of thing. So I understand people looking through a catalog and trying to evaluate the session based on the slides, but then I would go, okay, so the description and learning objectives aren't enough, but I don't know. I don't like having to turn in slides in advance, other than I know it helps the show know that we're prepared. But at the same time, I'm always tweaking my slides, a day or two before, because that's really when I put in, the hard work about I can take a session I've done before. I'll rearrange it. I'll have a new idea. I'll say, that didn't work. I'm going to put this in. I do all that kind of stuff. I don't know. Talk to me about that. This idea of people having the slides in advance. I guess the one idea I heard, and then I will turn it over to you. The one idea I heard that I can understand, some people said they follow the slides and they literally take notes like an app with the slides, which is interesting because my thumbs don't work that fast. On a mobile device or whatever, but I don't know. Thoughts on, I don't know. What do you think? I'm yeah. trying to avoid getting too wound up, but yeah, you hit on a hot button for me.
No, that's good. I happen to be blessed with a great memory and I don't feel that I need to take notes during presentations. However, whenever somebody says just a great quote, something that is just like, the sum of the words and the arrangement of the words is just really great. I tend to like text it to my wife or to my partner or email it to myself just because I want to maybe use it later in an internal presentation or use it in a video or something like that. But I do reserve those notes for like those few moments of high impact. And I think that when you are taking notes throughout the entire presentation, nothing really stands out. So my style really is I wait. I mean, out of a 100-minute session, I may get one quote that I absolutely love. And that's the only thing that I take with me. And I do remember the general session more or less. But I think, Kirk, it matters on the session too. Like there are sessions that there's absolutely no way that you go to a conference for 4 days and you take whatever, 8 to 10 classes and take zero notes and somehow come back and become a transformed person. It's just not possible. It's just too much information. So I think there are some sessions that have, sort of steps, how to do something. Like I was teaching a class on video editing. I mean, I honestly didn't expect anyone to come out as a perfect video editor right after one class and basically mix with all the other class that they took. So I'm actually okay with them taking notes. I took note. I said things about how long should the average video be based on my history. And I said 6 minutes. So people wrote down 6 minutes. Maybe you won't remember 6 minutes. That would be a good one to write down. Or maybe I'll say, there are top three reasons why you should go to Facebook or you should go to YouTube. And I give each one and people will take notes. I think it really depends on the session. Kirk, your sessions particularly are sessions that are more thought provoking. They're more about changing your mindset from A to B or kind of like pushing against the status quo. On how we should work with clients or how we should price our services or how we should conduct our business. So I think that for your sessions in particular, there may not be that many sort of steps that people need to write down. They just need to hear a couple of things that just click in their head and go, that's all I needed. That's exactly what I needed to transform. But like, for example, I had a class on inventory and there are so many steps to take, to like make an inventory adjustment. So I think it all depends on the type of class. Now turning in slides, I got to tell you, I could agree with you. I actually like your premise about, the class being intriguing enough. So you don't know what's going to come next. That way you're sort of paying attention and not just waiting for that one slide that you were interested on looking at it before. But you're dealing with accountants. I mean, we like documenting things. We like having documentation for after the fact. So I think that if you are going to speak at any accounting conferences, you're going to have to turn in your slides before the conference starts. I think that's just going to be for a while. Now, one thing I do have to learn from you, because I went to a couple of your classes, and actually, you know, it never occurred to me that you can have a slide with one word, and that's more powerful than a slide with six bullet points. I'm sort of an information geek, so my slides, if you go to any of my slides, you would actually probably vomit, you know, out of exhaustion. You know, I have like 100 slides, each of them with like seven bullet points, and you're gonna be like, oh my God, this guy wrote a book. You know, and I think a lot of it is the anxiety as a speaker that I want to make sure that I'm giving all the possible information. But I'm learning from watching you and other people that sometimes it's not the amount of information that you give that's valuable. Sometimes it's just that one thing that somebody needed to hear in order to walk out feeling transformed. So I actually agree that part of the effectiveness in communication is being as precise as possible and holding off that extra information until people ask for it, and just present enough to get people thinking about a narrow thing, not a bunch of things at the same time.
So a couple things. Number one, I totally want people to take notes. I have no problem with note taking. In fact, I love people who take notes. And when somebody says, hey, you know, I think there were a couple of my sessions where the slides had not been uploaded for the attendees to download yet at the beginning of the session. And, you know, when somebody says, hey, where's your slides? I take notes with them. I get that. I can understand that. And I want people to take notes. By the way, that is one reason why my slides are sparse, is because I want to force people to engage. One way I force them to engage is they have to listen. Number two, they have to take notes. If my slides have everything I say and all my bullet points, then, you know, what's the point, right? So I totally get that. I love people who take notes. I take notes, and I think note-taking is a skill that can be learned. So that being said, you know, I have no problem with people taking notes, and I certainly didn't mean to imply that I did. I also get that with a technical topic, you have to have more detail. Now, if you're doing a demo with software, unless you got, you know, literally two computers with two screens, you can literally have the slides on one screen and the demo on another. Slides can kind of get in the way, right? If you're trying to get back and forth. And so with technical, I think you'd have to have screenshots. So I hear you with technical presentations, and so I don't know, as I'm thinking out loud, and I literally am thinking out loud on this, I'm going, technical material. Well, if it's so technical, you have to show people how to do it, then how do heavy slides help with that? I'm not sure. But I guess my thing is, you know, and some people have the time, you know, to put together beautiful slides. I mean, you know, they have time to go out and pick pictures that perfectly capture every point, you know, and I love that. I know some of the people who do that have, you know, a team member who helps out with that. You know, they kind of do a draft and they have somebody who kind of creates a professional deck out of it. And I love that. I think that's awesome. You know, for me, when I create it, I actually, you know, I write out my slides in an outline. I actually then go back and start taking stuff out, not only taking out slides, but taking out words. So those slides that have two words, they may have started out with 8 or 10. And I figured out, you know, start out with a sentence, and I go, you know what? I don't need a sentence for that. I just need these two words. But those are some of my thoughts. Note-taking, I love. Technical, do you need dense slides? I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence there.
I'm thinking that, you know, now that we're talking, I'm thinking that, and this will be a lot of work for any presenter. I think that maybe two sets of slides is the sort of the sweet spot. So the slides that you're going to use for your presentation, and then I don't know if you want to call it slides, and then the slides that you give to people afterwards so they can use it to reflect upon what they learned. I think maybe that's the best of both worlds, you know, where maybe like a manuscript or like a guide of some sort that kind of summarizes what you spoke into sort of, you know, 3 pages, 4 pages, so people can use it. Kind of like, Kirk, when you have your podcast, right, where you have Art of Value, you have your podcast, and then you have the show notes afterwards. right? I think that maybe there's something to learn from that in live presentations. Whereas, you know, we will use these very simplistic slides with just pictures or a simple word, your style. And then we have another set of sort of take-home notes that kind of summarize the session. I think that may be the best of both worlds. I think it's more work, certainly more work for the presenting putting this together. But I think maybe that's the best of both worlds. And I'm thinking, you know, what kind of learnings can we draw from this, right? So let's see if we can somehow shift this back and make a segue into advisory. You know, what as a presenter, presenting an idea, selling an idea in public speaking with slides, how can we use what we've learned from that in our day-to-day advisory work? Where what do you think there's any lessons to be drawn from here? I'm thinking that maybe best of both worlds is we have two sets of slides, the ones that we use to present and the ones that we give to take home, which have two different styles of content. You know, the take home is a summary, kind of like show notes of a podcast, and the presentation is just used to add some value to your non-technical sort of thought leadership type of presentation. My question to you is, are there any lessons we can draw from that in our sort of day-to-day one-to-one advisory work that we do for our clients?
So I just want to back up and say, yeah, you know, the whole thing on the slides. Yes, I get your idea. Let's get off the topic of slides because, like I said, it's a hot button for me. I think how can we take some learning from that and apply it to advisory? I think number one, preparation is good, but the right type of preparation. I also think that you don't want, much like, you know, I invite audience participation in my sessions. I build it in. And one of the things I'm finding is the more I speak, the more I am relying on audience participation to help with learning. I enjoy that. People enjoy it. And so I would say we need to make sure we're using that in our conversations with clients. I'm thinking specifically of, you know, if you prepare a financials for somebody, or if you're walking through a proposal, don't just, you know, go through it and present it. Number one, don't send it. We've talked about that before. But number two, don't just present it. Make it into a conversation. Literally, if you have to stop and go, does anybody have any questions? You know, if you're speaking to an all group, I would say, does anybody have any questions or comments? Or, you know, if I'm with a customer, I'll stop and go, hey, I want to pause for a second. What questions do you have? So notice what I did there. I assume they have questions, right? I didn't say, do you have a question? I said, what questions do you have? And so that would be the one thing. But I think you're probably got a bigger takeaway than what I'm hitting on. What are your thoughts on your own question?
Yeah. So one of the things I'm thinking, and I'll ask you about that because you're sort of an expert in this topic. For example, when we're presenting options, right? We talk to our client or potential client, and they give us sort of a plethora of potential wants and needs. And we give them three options. We give them option A for, let's say, $500, option B for $1,000, option C for $2,000, just to say a number. And when we present these options, we have these things in writing, right? We basically have them, maybe three pieces of paper with a sort of a mini shortened proposal for each one, or maybe one piece of paper with all three options next to each other. Well, that's kind of a sort of a PowerPoint presentation, right? I mean, it doesn't have a slide or doesn't have a projector, but you're giving a client a handout or something visual to talk and explain what you're presenting. So my first question is that how you suggest we present options with sort of a visual? And the bullet points that go under each one would be like the services that you're rendering under each of the options. So is that supposed to be like really short and summarized? Or is that supposed to be more complete? What is your take on, you know, how much information do we give when we're visually presenting an option or a service to our client, maybe in a piece of paper, which is a sort of representative of a slide in a live presentation?
So when you're presenting three options to the customer in a proposal, there's basically two formats. I'm sure there's probably more, but there's basically two formats. One is linear, you know, where I typically start, and this is the way I like to do it. I like to start with the highest option because when I get to options two and three, I'm simply saying, okay, option two is the same as option one, but we're going to take this and this out. Option three is the same as option one, but we're going to take these four things out. That's how I present it. Another way to do it is the table format, which you see in a lot of SaaS software sites. You know, you go to the QuickBooks site and they may offer, you know, two or three different plans. Well, different plans have different features. And so they'll show you, a lot of times you'll see two orders with that table. You'll either see the lowest option on the left, middle option in the middle, and highest option on the right. Or one thing I've seen recently is they're now taking the highest option, putting it in the middle. So either a linear format or table format, I think, work great. I'm not so concerned about which one. There's probably advantages to both. For me, it's more about the fact that I'm setting the context for the customer. I'm walking them through it. So I think either one of those work.
Okay, well, let me break that down, because I think that you just given us like really, really good information. So when you're going to offer three options, you say that you start with the highest option that has, for example, let's just say 10 bullet points of all the things that we're going to do, right? Reconcile the bank, give you financial statements, a monthly coaching call, 2 hours of training, or maybe half day, so we don't do hours, half day of training to your staff, follow up with a particular strategy plan or business plan, whatever it is, right? So you put all the bullet points, you say, this is the top tier service that we can offer. Then on you take that away, let's just say that's one page, you offer the next one, you're going to say it's going to be the same thing as this, but we're going to take away these four bullet points. And this is the price. And then we're going to go to the next one, which is the same sort of system, and we're going to take away these three or four bullet points. So that's one approach that you like, which you start with the highest option. You give all the services that are included, or you know, let's call it the scope, and you take them away as you go. Is there a particular reason, maybe psychologically speaking, why you go that approach where you take away instead of add? Is there something significance to that?
Oh, definitely. We want what we can't have. There's a psychological principle of when you pull away, the customer has a subtle psychological, you know, really subconscious draw toward what they can't have. So that's why. I also do it because I am most proud of my highest option. And so all my effort goes into creating that. It's interesting. I used to, you know, rather than put my time into, you know, create my base option and then, okay, what can I add to that? What can I add to that? It's easier for me just to write out the highest option, the best thing I can think of, put all my creativity into that, and then just start pulling stuff out to get the lower option. So there's a, you know, psychological effect that with the customer, but then there's also just the practicality of, I really put all my effort into creating one amazing option, and then I pull stuff out to get you know, the lower ones. Now, sometimes I already have in mind what I will pull out. Sometimes I don't. Literally, sometimes I don't know what my other options are going to be until I've written the top option. So that's the other way that I think about it.
Okay. And then the table format is the one where they're all being displayed at the same time, right? This is the visually speaking. And usually you're saying some people do good, better, best, where they do the lowest option on the left and the highest on the right. And that's just because we're accustomed to go that route. I think you could go the other route too, where you can go the highest on the left and the lowest on the right. I mean, it depends on how you want people to look at it. Like, so if you subscribe to Kirk's approach, which is we want what we can't have, you want to put it on the table first and then take it away so people feel that, you know, they're missing out if they don't get it. Whereas, I mean, so some of the school of thoughts would think that logically speaking, you want to start with the lowest one so you don't scare people away and then let people sort of sink in value and progress as it goes. I think that Kirk, maybe it also depends on the audience. Like some of the audience would probably react better to having the highest up front or the lowest up front. And go, so that could change. But I do like the fact that if you listen to your customer very, very, very well and very intently, and you start by saying, look, after we spoke for 45 minutes or so yesterday, I had time to think about what are all the deliverables that you want. And I put all the deliverables on the table and turn them into one service. This is a sort of a big task. And we're going to put a whole bunch of resources to that. And we can offer this. Here's what we got to offer. And then you say, look, and if your business is not ready for all that, but you do want to work together, and I think there's a lot of value us working together, we can maybe pull back and then maybe concentrate more on those core needs, on those immediate needs that you have that are still going to solve a lot of problems for you, but maybe it won't encompass the entire conversation that we had in mind. So I like that very much. What other, are there any other visual techniques that you can think of on proposals? Like I know you, I've heard you say once that you never send a proposal up front and let people look at it too much until you talk to them. Can you speak to that?
Well, sure. I mean, and that it's not, I never send a proposal. Customer asks for a proposal before the meeting. My answer is a polite no. And they ask why. I'll say, because I want to walk you through it. Also, I may tweak some things right before we jump on the phone. So bottom line, no, you can't have it. And most customers are fine with that. Usually, you know, and usually the best answer to that is what I find is really the way I answer it is to say, hey, can you send me the proposal? I go, you know what? I'd rather walk you through it, but I will send you a copy immediately after our meeting. And I, sometimes if I need to, I'll add, by the way, we may change some things. So I want to make sure what I send you, you know, has any revisions that we make. Usually people are understanding with that. So as far as visual, not really. I mean, if you need a visual presentation, I think the table format works well, just because, you know, you're going to have three cells in the table, low, medium, and high, and the highest one's going to be the one with the most bullet points, right? And the middle is going to, you know, be less than that, and the low is going to be less than that. So if you're looking for a visual, that's about the best one I can think of. I don't rely on visuals. I really rely on the discussion, and that's why I encourage not sending the proposal, is because the whole point of a proposal, the point of a proposal is not to wow the customer with your brilliance. The point of a proposal is to confirm what you have already talked about. Now, you may not have talked about it in the exact way, but if a customer is totally blown away by what you show them, then you probably haven't had as deep a conversation as you needed to. I'm not saying everything in the proposal they need to be expecting. Everybody likes a little Christmas gift. Everybody likes a little surprise. So I always like to have something in the proposal that the customer is not expecting. But at the same time, I want to walk the customer through it because I want to set the context. I don't want them to get it in advance and read through it and start making decisions about what they want to buy or how they think it's should be done. Or better yet, you know, if they had, you know, bad pizza for lunch and they have an upset stomach, or they had a fight with, you know, a coworker or a spouse, I don't want any of that affecting the context of how they read the proposal. And I really don't want them reading it. To be honest, what I want is a conversation, and I want the proposal to be the best it can be. And part of that I found is, even though I have, you know, done my due diligence, bottom line, they are going to ask questions and say things that are going to cause me to revise my thinking. And my best thinking is not my best thinking until it has survived interaction with a customer. And survive interaction, I make it sound negative. It's really something positive. I want the customer's input, because it doesn't matter how much effort I put in, how good I think it is, the customer always adds something that causes me to do better.
And I think it was business school that screwed us up, right? Because you know, college and even high school, they tell us that whatever we turn in has to tell the complete story, you know, as if the other person is just reading your work and that's it. They're supposed to make a decision based on your work, you know, just like they talk about persuasive writing and that sort of thing. But you know, as an advisor, how you sell is very indicative of how you will serve your client. So if you are going to be giving them a bunch of words for them to read and then they make a decision based on those words, your clients could also imply that that's what your relationship will be like. You're going to send them an email with instructions and that's it. And I think a lot of folks just don't want that. A lot of folks want you to sit down next to them, both look at the same problem, consult with each other on how each other sees the problem or perceives that to be a problem, try out a couple of, you know, give a couple of options in terms of solutions and how to go about it. And then in a collaborative effort, go tackle the problem. And if your proposal doesn't show that up front, if that's not the way you are working with your client in terms of agreeing how to work together, it could be very indicative in how you will serve your customer. And if your customer actually wants to work in a collaborative manner, I think they would want the proposal process. Let's just not call it a proposal where we go in there and we propose. No, it's a process, and it's an interaction. And the proposals, as you say, they're very much alive. I mean, they're a dynamic document. They could be during the proposal stage, the client will go, you know what? I think you misunderstood what I meant by this. I actually meant this to be important, not that. And you're like, oh, okay, I get it. And you can change that proposal on the fly, and that could change the scope. It could change the price. It could change the timeline. It could change the amount of resources that you're putting in place. So I actually love the idea of basically bringing an open Word document as a proposal, not a, let's just call it not a PDF document. So it's an open Word document, not a PDF document, something that's still dynamic, can still change on the fly. Now, one thing I tell you that I heard from Blair Enns, a person that's been in your podcast before, he's the author of a book called Pricing Creativity, a guide to something about the billable hour. And he says that before you go out and write your proposal, it's important to give your customer some sort of guidance so that you can gauge right off the bat to see if there's any objections. So I don't know if you heard him say this, but I think this is brilliant. When you're done with the first conversation, before you come back with the proposal, you say, look, you've given us a lot to think about. I think I'm going to offer you some options on what we can offer. The options will range, and you say this right before you leave. This is like your finishing statement before you leave. The proposal will range anywhere between $5,000 to $15,000. I'll get back to tomorrow with some options. And that's it. You end the conversation like that. And by giving them that pricing guidance, you're not committing to a number. You're giving them a wide number. You know, maybe you're even risking giving the wrong guide if you go back and realize that your lower could be lower or your higher could be higher. But it just gives you a good idea, more or less, if the client has an immediate objection, maybe about the highest one or the lowest one. You want to hear that right there and then. That way, when you come back and to bring your proposal, you don't get completely blindsided by the fact that you're giving a proposal that contains a dollar amount that's way within budget. Within that budget range. So I don't know if you heard that before, what you think about that. Because although we're talking about proposal, which is just scope and words, we haven't even talked about pricing. You know, pricing will at the end basically rule the entire conversation, right? Or it would be, contextually speaking, it will take over the conversation once prices are given. So don't we want to have some, preemptively speaking, have a sort of an idea of what that price range or budget looks like before we come back with our proposal?
So first of all, yes, Blair has a new book. It's called Pricing Creatively. And part of the play on words there is Blair is a consultant kind of in the creative space, meaning advertising, graphic design, all that type of stuff. And one of the points he makes in this book is you should actually, and you know, Ron Baker has an axiom from Verisage that I quote a lot, you know, price the customer, not the service. Well, Blair puts that into practice by quoting a price to the customer before he ever gets to scope. He wants to quote a price during that first range. Some people might call it, you know, testing the water, finding out what the budget is, finding out what they're willing to invest. But he literally has the why conversation. Then he goes, okay, you know, and he might give them a range or he might just give them a price, but he basically prices the customer in advance. And Blair says, look, I'm not willing to spend all the time it takes to put a proposal and scope together if they're not going to buy off on the price. So let's just get it out there at the beginning. That's kind of what you're leading to. So that is, I think, a very advanced pricing technique. I think learning to price completely without scope is kind of like, you know, trying to learn trapeze without a net. I think it's certainly a way to go. And I certainly get there. I mean, there's a lot of times I haven't got to the point where I'm quoting the price to the customer in the first call. A lot of times because the why conversation winds up being, you know, two or three conversations with me and my customers because the projects are more complex. But I definitely am already thinking, you know, some numbers in my head. You know, I'm first call, obviously I've come up with, before I've ever come up with the detailed scope, I may have an idea of what the scope might be, but you know, I haven't gone to the detail to write it in a proposal. So yeah, that's what Blair's talking about is, you know, price comes first, scope comes later. And there's different points of view on that. I think you definitely have to have a scope, but yeah, certainly that's one way to do it. And I think there are advantages to it.
The other thing that he said on that same podcast, which it all has to do with this whole, you know, scoping, pricing, and presenting. And I think I really liked the way he put this together, and I may be paraphrasing, is he says there's also another advanced technique, which is testing for the artificial ceiling, okay? Which means, you know, just kind of take a look more or less of what is that maximum number that the client is willing to pay. And that is what most accounting professionals, my colleagues, get worried about. It's like, you know, our customers are never going to give us a number. You know, they just get really sunk in that customers will never give you a number, that this is a mysterious number that they will never give away. But one of the things that we fail to see is that in the accounting profession specifically, our work could have impact in people's bottom line. You know, just like he does on advertising, of course, which is something that has an impact on sales. But our work can have impact on bottom line. I mean, accountants can save people money on taxes. They can save people money on finding overage of expenditures. Some accountants, when they're really good at pricing, they can help their clients pinpoint what products are underpriced or not making enough margin, or helping them figure out which are the big money makers so they can promote those, not the little money makers. So there's a lot of work that accountants can do that has a direct impact on the bottom line. So one of his techniques, advanced techniques that he mentions to test the artificial ceiling, is to say, after you figure out what the clients want and you talk about results, and let's say, for example, the results happen to be where the customer says, look, one of the results I'm looking for is a better bottom line, or one of the results I'm looking for is a reduction in taxes, or one of the results I'm looking for is to, you know, cut a staff member or two, and through the work that we'll do together, we'll be able to maintain our operations and at the end have more profit. So if you could guarantee the result, and this is kind of like a really advanced technique where you tell your customer, look, if we could guarantee that result, let's say, for example, the result is, just to say a number, $20,000 in the bottom line. If we could guarantee the results, and I'm not saying we could, but hypothetically speaking, if we could guarantee the result of $20,000, you think it would be fair for me to price it at $25,000? I mean, at $2,500? Oh, sorry, $5,000. Let's just say 25%. So $5,000. So would it be fair that if we could guarantee a result of $20,000, you think it would be fair for us to price it for $5,000? Or you can use any multiple, right? But, you know, 20 to 30% of that result. And most of the time when you frame it that way and the customer goes, wait a second, you can guarantee $20,000 impact in my bottom line? You can say, no, not necessarily. I'm not saying I can, but I'm saying hypothetically speaking, if I could add some language to my contract where I would guarantee those results, would pricing at a $5,000 or $10,000 make sense to you? And if the customer at that point says yes, you are already probing that artificial ceiling. However, it is tied with a guarantee of a result. And I think that's another just a piece that a lot of accounting professionals get extremely worried about, is that, oh, we're accountants, we should not be guaranteeing any results. Well, why not? You know, why not? I know it's risky. You know, it's going to be, somebody's taking a risk. Look, your customers are taking a risk by dishing out a couple thousand dollars to pay you, not knowing what the result is going to be. So why are accountants so afraid of taking a risk and guaranteeing some sort of result, whatever that result may be? I don't know, Kirk, if you have any thoughts of that, or if you know you had a class that you taught risk. You know, what kind of, when you were telling people run towards risk, what reaction were they giving you?
Well, and that class was really about teaching the truth that business, you cannot have a business without taking risk, that being an entrepreneur is about undertaking risk. And, you know, so many times we want a sure thing nowadays, and helping the accountants and bookkeepers in the audience in that particular session, you know, to realize, number one, that they need to undertake some risk. Accountants tend to be very risk averse because, you know, they are so focused on the historical numbers, and trying to help them, you know, look forward and begin to look into the future with their customers, but also realize they're doing it in their own business and they need to help their customers do it as well, because their customers are also running a business that is based on taking risk, and profit comes from risk. So that's what that class was about. But a word that you mentioned that I want to get back to is the guarantee. There's multiple types of guarantees. And we talk about offering guarantee. There's a couple guarantees that I think are very easy to put in your proposal because you kind of offer them already. They're just unstated. One is a service guarantee, which basically says if you're not satisfied, we'll do what it takes to make you happy or refund all or a portion of your money. And then there's a price guarantee, which is actually a benefit to both you and the customer. All guarantees are a benefit to both parties, but particularly a price guarantee because it says this is a fixed price for a fixed scope of work. If the scope of work changes, we're going to issue a change request with the new scope and price. That sets the precedent with the customer that, hey, if there's a change, we are going to give you something in writing. So the price is not going to go up, but also sets the expectation that if there is a change, there will be an additional price to pay because it's something that's out of scope. But the third type of guarantee that you're talking about is guarantee the result. It is more risky than the others. You know, the reason guaranteeing a result is risky is because a lot of times the results that our customers are seeking doesn't totally depend on us, meaning the professional. It depends on the customer. In other words, my ability as a professional to guarantee that result is out of my control. So when you're guaranteeing a result, now I guess you could guarantee a very conservative result, but you know, the more risky the guarantee, the higher the price you'd be paid for it. So if you're guaranteeing a result that requires a bit from the customer to get it, you're going to help them get there. Then number one, you need to make sure that there's a price tied to that, some type of bonus or incentive to make it worth it. But also realize, you know, it's kind of hard to do that. I think it depends on whether if you're delivering a similar result customer after customer after customer, you know, like you're an e-commerce consultant and your job is to help customers increase sales. And you know, on average that your customers see a 15% boost within 6 months and you want to guarantee that, fine. You've got results. That's something, you know, that you can guarantee. 15% increase is valuable to a customer. It's something you're fairly confident in your ability. Now, if you're going to stretch out there and go, well, I'm going to guarantee double that. Now, here's one concept that I've thought about before. I've never experimented with, but actually using different guarantees and options. So like you could literally have the difference in two options literally be, okay, with option B, I'm going to guarantee a 15% result. With option A, I'm going to guarantee a 30% result. I've never tried that, but certainly could fall in line.
Yeah. And just to kind of wrap things up, sometimes some of these results, as you mentioned, they're beyond our control. Like, but if you're an accountant that does everything after the fact, where all you do is tell the story of what the customer did, right? A historian, then yeah, you can't guarantee any result because all you're doing is accounting for what the customer did. So, you know, so if you're thinking, oh, well, that's impossible. Well, that's because it's the type of service that you're providing. If the type of service you're providing is giving customer history of what they did, then there's nothing you can guarantee. I mean, you can guarantee to have it done in time. You can guarantee to give them the information as quick as possible. You can guarantee that their entire organization will have working knowledge of exactly what happened in their finances with details, with graphs, with detailed reports, summary reports, whatever happens to be. You can guarantee that, but you cannot guarantee a result if you're not involved with your client's operations. So the type of work that you have to do something like that would be different than what a traditional accountant does. You're going to have to work with your client in a weekly basis. You're going to have to get into the warehouse and help them clean up the warehouse. You're going to have to listen to the sales process of the salespeople. You're going to have to give them your opinion about how they're spending money in marketing. You're going to have to measure the results of their marketing. I mean, there's just a lot of things that we can do as accounting professionals, even if we're shy, even if we're not experts in marketing, but it would really fall outside of the realm of what traditional accounting professionals do. So in order to do something like that, you may also have to transform your business model as well. So Kirk, we're up to the hour now. And did we miss something important? Did you want to mention something else before we wrap things up?
I just want to reinforce what you said is that if you're, as a professional, only focused on history, there's really not much you can guarantee. In order to guarantee things that matter, you have to be focused on the future. And focusing on the future involves taking risk.
Absolutely. I don't think I could have said it better. Thank you, Kirk, and I'll see you next week.
See you.